Welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 22nd of January 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, we don't have Horace here this week. He will be back next week for more of the Culture of Critique series. But we do have with us today a history expert. We have with us Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rustjournal.org, the Barnes Review, and of course the Orthodox Nationalist here at Radio Albion, and he also joins me on Thursdays to co-host with the Daily Nationalist, where we look at geopolitics, and today we're going to be looking at revolutions. Matt, good day, sir. Thank you very much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I certainly hope listeners will tolerate my filling in for a day. If they don't, they can complain about it in the forum.
I'm sure they will enjoy it. I'm very grateful for you coming on. And of course, I mean, a lot of the time here on Truthful Out Radio, we deal with the Second World War, communism, conspiracies, Freemasonry, and a lot of it ties in with revolutions. And of course, you're an expert, particularly on the Russian Revolution. So to be looking at revolutions today and also how that ties in with what's going on in America at the moment, because America is in the throes of a revolution, I think it'll be very enlightening for our listeners to hear what we've got in store for them tonight. And I'll just say here at the beginning that you've provided these quotes for us. I have to admit, I haven't actually read these authors. I've heard of them. They get quoted all the time, but I haven't actually read them. So I'm very grateful for you providing the notes for this, Matt. And perhaps we should start with a definition of what revolution actually is. And the definition that I've got for this comes from Wikipedia. And they say, in political science, a revolution is a fundamental and relatively sudden change in political power and political organization, which occurs when the population revolts against the government, typically due to perceived oppression, political, social, or economic, or political incompetence. And of course, we often hear about the National Socialist Revolution, and yet by this definition here, which says it's the population revolting against the government, then the National Socialist Revolution was not a revolution. And I have to bring that up because typically when we look at revolutions in history, they always turn out really badly for the people. I can't think of one that has actually turned out well for the people, apart from the so-called National Socialist Revolution, which, as we see here, it wasn't actually a revolution. The National Socialist government were voted in. There wasn't a revolt against the government here. Whereas what we see in America, we see that the election has been stolen. That is a revolt against the established government. The established government was the Donald Trump government. About the only other revolution I could think of was the Gaddafi revolution, the Green Revolution, and I know that took place without a shot being fired. There was no blood that was shed, and also revolutions are extremely, extremely bloody things. So what do you think of this definition here of revolution, Matt? Should something be added to it? Is there more that we should talk about here?
I have a few problems with it, only in that this was one of the very first concepts I ever came across doing politics in college. And a lot of this comes from both Russell Kirk and Edmund Burke. A revolution, in its true sense, is not just about the state. It's about completely remaking society. I did my doctoral dissertation on Michael Oakeshott of the London School of Economics and the relationship between language and political revolution, that even the definitions of terms, how they're used, what they refer to, completely gets remade when that happens. The American so-called revolution wasn't a revolution. They didn't want to change society. It was simply a war of independence. What we do with, say, National Socialism or Gaddafi's case or Hafez al-Assad years ago, that's a counter-revolution. They're returning society back to some version of natural law. So a revolution is, by definition, a leftist movement because it wants to destroy natural law, any kind of connection with nature, and instead remake society based on some ideological blueprint. Because people don't respond to ideological blueprints and they don't all agree, they have to use violence. They have to use every kind of manipulation imaginable. What we do, even if it's just intellectually, is counter-revolution. Otherwise, it's just, you know, a change of government, even though it may be a radical one. But a revolution is, by definition, leftist. It's based on an ideological blueprint, and it's about changing everything in a society in accordance with that blueprint, all the way down to family life and language and your gestures and everything else. So that's how I would challenge that definition. It's not just about government.
Well, that would fit in with the Adolf Hitler is often called the man against time. This name that he had, and people wonder what that means. And it's because he was trying to hold up progress. And of course, we think progress is a good thing. But I guess what you're inferring to here, Matt, is that when they talk about progress and progressivism, it's the revolution that's actually progressing, and we are trying to stop that because we know that it's a progress that is degenerate. It's not really progressing. It's going backwards. Would that be correct?
Yeah. And the other problem is the use of the word the population. I don't think the population as a unit has ever done anything. That's very, very vague. The leftist revolutions that I'm talking about here are always top down. It's a faction of the oligarchy that wants to impose its will on something. The population as a unit, I don't even know what that refers to. Revolutions, really anything of political value, either good or bad, comes from small groups of very determined, fanatical people. That's how anything ever gets done, pretty much in anything, but especially in politics. Fanatical minorities, often very small fanatical minorities, are the drivers of history. The population is so vague; it was cringy to read that.
And of course, these grassroots rebellions. I mean, that's what we have, is grassroots rebellion. And of course, we don't have any funding; we can't get anywhere with it, and we're not supposed to get anywhere with it, as we will see as we go on. Because what this really is, this is the conclusion of our past actions. It's the result of actions that we have made in the past, decisions that have been made, the degeneracy of society. It gets to a certain stage where there becomes this force against it, and that gets not hijacked, because it's actually started by these other powers, by the oligarchs, by our opponents. And we'll start with a quote here from Edmund Burke, which really describes this well. This is from Reflections on the Revolution in France from 1790. He says, "They who do not love religion hate it. The rebels to God perfectly abhor the author of their being. They hate him with all their heart, with all their mind, with all their soul, and with all their strength. He never presents himself to their thoughts, but to menace and alarm them. They cannot strike the sun out of heaven, but they are able to raise a smouldering smoke that obscures him from their own eyes. Not being able to revenge themselves upon God, they have a delight in vicariously defacing, degrading, torturing, and tearing in pieces his image in man." And I think that's a very poetical way of describing something that we see within our leaders. I mean, when I look at somebody like Biden, he just looks so evil to me. And so many of the politicians just look like evil people. And what they do is evil to the people. We sometimes say, well, how can they do what they do? Do they not understand that the harm that they're causing? And a lot of the time they do understand the harm that they're causing, and it's being deliberately done, and it's done out of this hatred against God, this spitefulness against God. And it leads to the degeneration of society, and the people rebel, and they use the rebellion of the people to put an even worse regime in place. That's what happens. That's what the revolution is. It's the wheel that turns, and when it gets back to the place that it was in, it's even worse than it was before. Do you want to expand on this bit here about them hating religion, Matt?
My junior year in college, I did my senior thesis a year early for some reason, and Edmund Burke and John Adams were the two people I focused on, especially in this area. God, of course, is the creator of natural law, politically and every other way. but he's symbolized on Earth by the monarch and the father of the family, the principle of reason, the sun, sometimes symbolized in gold, the number one, a reason most commonly. And you notice these are all the things that the French Revolution did everything it could to efface. It's not an accident that the role of the father, which is essential to social life, is under attack. There's definitely a gender thing here. The research that homosexual males are the way they are because they didn't have a father figure or he was very bad or abusive is pretty tremendous. Without a strong father figure, the family tends to fall to pieces. You don't have that rational principle there, the principle of strength and unity and protection. So the hatred of God comes out in the hatred of the family and the murder of the monarch. The old Gnostic ritual of the killing of the king and all the energy and legitimacy that the king has is then stolen by the oligarchs. And that's essentially what a republic is. Comes from Edmund Burke's attack on the French Revolution. He was an Irishman, though a Protestant, and a member of the British Parliament in this period of time, and was very famous for his attack on the French Revolution. He became one of the founders of modern, to use a vague term, conservatism, precisely for this book in 1790.
So they subvert the king so that he's then become demoralized and immoral, which gets the people upset, and then they sponsor the people to take down the king and replace the king. And I just find it interesting here that he focuses on religion as well as talking about God. He's actually talking about religion, and religion is unifying. And we know that our opponents hate anything that unifies us as white people, like nationalism. They don't want us to be nationalists. They don't want us to have our religion either. They have to debase our Christianity so that we have transsexuals in churches having the equivalent of baptisms and christenings. They have to debase it. They don't want us to have this unifying religion because it unifies us, and also because it dictates how they're supposed to treat us, and they are supposed to adhere to the laws within that. So they will seek to subvert that. So it's not just God that they hate, it's also the religion and all the trappings of God. And from that, it leads to revolution. And the next quote that I have here is from Solzhenitsyn from his Templeton Prize lecture in 1983. And he says, "What is more, the events of the Russian Revolution can only be understood now, at the end of the century, against the backdrop of what has since occurred in the rest of the world. What emerges here is a process of universal significance, and if I were called upon to identify briefly the principal trait of the entire 20th century, here too I would be unable to find anything more precise and pithy than to repeat once again, men have forgotten God. The failings of human consciousness, deprived of its divine dimension, have been a determining factor in all the major crimes of this century. The first of these was World War I, and much of our present predicament can be traced back to it. That war, the memory of which seems to be fading, took place when Europe, bursting with health and abundance, fell into a rage of self-mutilation that could not but sap its strength for a century or more, and perhaps forever. The only possible explanation for this war is a mental eclipse among the leaders of Europe due to their lost awareness of a supreme power above them. Only a godless embitterment could have moved ostensibly Christian states to employ poison gas, a weapon so obviously beyond the limits of humanity. The same kind of defect, the flaw of a consciousness lacking all divine dimension, was manifested after World War II, when the West yielded to the satanic temptation of the nuclear umbrella. It was equivalent to saying, let's cast off our worries, let's free the younger generation from its duties and obligations, let's make no effort to defend ourselves, to say nothing of defending others, let's stop our ears to the groans emanating from the East, and let us live instead in the pursuit of happiness. If danger should threaten us, we shall be protected by the nuclear bomb. If not, then let the world be burned in hell for all we care." And I'll just say that I'll just stop there, Matt. And I just wonder what do you think if he could see the world today, just how far it has descended over the last 10 years, where we now have children encouraged to be transsexuals and feeding them the opposite hormones and telling them that they should be mutilating themselves, and homosexuals claiming to be married, the changing of the actual term marriage itself, so that it is no longer the marriage act and it just becomes a piece of paper that's handed out by the state. All of this rapid dive to the bottom as fast as we can actually go. And he puts this as really beginning just before the First World War. And that really was when we were at the pinnacle. And the white world was at its pinnacle just before the First World War. And since then, everything has fallen apart, since we literally went to war against all of our brothers and brought everybody else in the world into this war as well. Do you want to comment on this, Matt?
Oh, there's so much here. I mean, I wouldn't even know where to begin here. I don't think Solzhenitsyn would at all be shocked, given what's going on now, because the minute the principle of reason, natural law, and unity is removed, then anything goes. The only thing you have left is power and will. The destruction of the father figure is essential. And Solzhenitsyn says that in many places. It's no accident that your big three leftist revolutions, the Glorious Revolution, the French Revolution, and the Russian, and there's a bunch like the one in the Netherlands, there's a bunch of them. They all have this one thing in common, and that is the apogee, the ritual of the murder of the monarch. You know, Charles, Louis, and Nicholas. The very fact that they would use something like poison gas is proof that the human being didn't have a soul or an essence. It was just matter in motion. What difference does it make if it's just matter in motion? The rage of self-mutilation is something that we're dealing with right now, with what people are doing to their bodies. Whenever you remove God, you remove natural law, you remove any restraint on the power of the state, or in our case, the power of capital, some coercive power, they now have no limits. It's essential for any revolution to take place that the idea of God be completely removed from the mind. It's no accident that the Romanian communists, right after World War II, created the Pitești experiments using all kinds of homosexual rituals, fecal play, everything else to deliberately destroy the idea of God in the minds of their political prisoners. And if that were then transferred to society, they would destroy the public understanding of God. Well, it has been used on an entire society, the Western world right now, and for the very same purpose. It's no accident that in that prison experiment, the communists in the 40s and early 50s, the exact same kind of sick, homosexual, sexual revolutionary ideas were used that now is being promoted as love and legitimate sexuality in the West every single day. That is no accident. That kind of thing, if it's made public and forced on you, will at one point efface the idea of God from all but the most sensitive people.
I think the people, when they came back from the First War as well, they were really traumatized by that, by seeing so much death. And the killing was on a scale that had never been seen before with the First War. And then you've got the gassing as well. And ever since then, we've had accusations against everybody else about them using gas. And it was us that used gas on our brothers, this horrific death that it forced upon people. Churchill wanted to use it on the Kurds. And our actual people, the actual population, were sickened by this. They did not want to be doing this. It was all done secretly, these attacks, like the terror bombing of Germany when we got to the Second World War. But all of this traumatizes the people. So then we see the symptoms of the trauma with the self-harm, as you're saying, with the transsexual mutilation, but also just self-harming anyway. We have teenagers that self-harm a lot. We have fashions that revolve around self-harming because we've been cut off from our traditions and our roots as well. So our people look around to try and find other people's traditions because they seem more exciting than our own, because we've been cut off from our own. So We'd also had various other revolutions, like the French Revolution, the Glorious Revolution, that had taken place. And so all throughout Europe, there had been this degeneration of morals, and it really culminated in Russia with this Bolshevik Revolution, which Solzhenitsyn is identifying as being caused by this lack of religiosity. He quotes, he talks about Dostoevsky next. He says, "It was Dostoevsky once again who drew from the French Revolution and its seething hatred of the church the lesson that revolution must necessarily begin with atheism. That is absolutely true, but the world had never known before a godlessness as organized, militarized, and tenaciously malevolent as that practiced by Marxism. Within the philosophical system of Marx and Lenin, and at the heart of their psychology, hatred of God is the principal driving force, more fundamental than all their political and economic pretensions. Militant atheism is not merely incidental or marginal to communist policy, it is not a side effect, but the central pivot. To achieve its diabolical ends, communism needs to control a population devoid of religious and national feeling, and this entails the destruction of faith and nationhood. Communists proclaim both of these objectives openly, and just as openly, go about carrying them." Matt, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, that's perfectly acceptable. It's hard to deny this. I've said in the Russian case, you had functioning idealistic Christian socialism all over the place. In the urban artel system of shared labor, the peasant commune, you had legitimate socialism, not just in Russia, but all over the place. This wasn't Marxism. It wasn't based on materialism. It was based on, you know, the soul and legitimate traditional ideas, especially the church. That was one of the first things that the Soviets destroyed when they came to power, claiming that they care about labor, which they define in a very different way. And this is a fundamental premise of my book on the Soviet Union, the Soviet experiment. Labor had nothing to do with anything. Those institutions that actually did elevate labor and function what you would think would be legitimate socialist principles of shared labor and family feeling, what was the first thing that was burned to the ground when the Soviets took over? They would destroy the peasant commune and then attempt to recreate it based on a collective of just random individuals that they threw together and forced them to work. And of course, it failed completely. The fact that you had urban Jews running the rural communes, they knew nothing about farming. It didn't matter. They had the West feeding them anyway. And he's absolutely right. This kind of intense atheism is essential. The fact that those institutions were based on the church and always were is exactly what the problem was. If the church is allowed to do what it's supposed to do and people understand God and the creation of natural law, then there are intense limits, very powerful limits on what the state or any power can do. You eliminate that, and now you could do whatever you want. There is no place to stand to condemn anything like this happening. And it's no accident, of course, the exact same thing is happening here. Legitimate unity is based around divine natural law and nationhood. And that's exactly what they're destroying, ironically enough, in the name of unity. And this kind of cognitive dissonance is so intense, you know it's being done on purpose. It's being done to inculcate neurosis in the population so that we just absolutely lose. We lose all faith, all hope, and we go and sink into a deep depression. And then that means they win and they rule entirely. We have to avoid that at all costs.
Well, I think it really began with the Enlightenment, didn't it? Sowing this disbelief in God and critical analysis of the Bible and making out that it was all fairy tales and it wasn't meant to be taken seriously. Then we ended up with the atheism and people who thought that they were being particularly clever by being atheist. And now we've ended up with the church being entirely subverted. So the people that do go to church and that do think that they're Christian and they're being good Christian people are in actual fact not doing that at all. In actual fact, they're doing the opposite of it. They're actually upholding the most immoral regime that we've ever had in the history of the world. I think it's just as bad as it was in Babylon. I mean, Christ said that at the end of the world, it will be just the same as it was before the flood. And I firmly believe that the same thing that we were seeing back then is what we are seeing today. So the morals degenerate more and more and more. And I think what we see, what we saw with Donald Trump, he was playing that king figure. He was in charge, but he wasn't able to do anything. He didn't actually set up a particularly moral type of person. He did say he was going to clean up the swamp and all the rest of it, but he used bad language. He didn't set a particularly good moral example, and he's now been toppled, and we now have essentially a revolutionary government there in America that has taken place after this degeneration of morals. And this is what John Adams talks about, how democracy will soon degenerate into an anarchy, such an anarchy that every man will do what is right in his own eyes, and no man's life or property or reputation or liberty will be secure. And every one of these will soon mould itself into a system of subordination of all the moral virtues and intellectual abilities, all the powers of wealth, beauty, wit, and science, to the wanton pleasures, the capricious will, and the execrable cruelty of one or a very few. And we see this now, that people with high morals are ridiculed and mocked, and people with intellectual abilities that really do want to investigate the world around them, properly investigate it, they don't get the funding, because it's going to turn out results that are not politically correct. It's going to say that the races exist. It's going to say that homosexuality is a cultural thing. People are not born like that. It's going to say that there are differences between the genders. And you cannot get away from that. So anybody that is actually intellectually honest and in the pursuit of science is not going to get the funding, and they're not going to get the exposure. And the people that are going to get the exposure are going to be the people that are telling us lies, just telling us what we want to hear, just telling us, massaging our ears with platitudes and flattery. And of course, that's what we heard when Biden took office the other day. We just heard all these platitudes and all this nothingness that was coming out of his mouth. And we see that there is anarchy on the streets. We had part of that with Black Lives Matter. But just this week, when Biden was actually put into office, when he was inaugurated, there were Black Lives Matter riots and Antifa riots in Seattle, and also I forget the name of the other place, the place where they had 100 days of it last summer, the one where they actually had that CHAZ thing, the temporary autonomous
Portland
zone. Yeah, that's it, Portland. They had riots there as well. So this is continuing. What carried on this summer is going to continue. I think we know where this ends up. That's what John Adams is saying anyway.
Well, of course, John Adams, the second president of the United States and one of the greatest political theorists of the colonial era. Very few people read him anymore for some reason. I'm not a big Federalist, but John Adams was the dominant political mind at the time. The difference here is that given this is written in 1763, prior to the American War of Independence, he's saying, the democracy will degenerate into anarchy. People will do whatever they want. The concept of this being led by a more or less secretive force didn't exist at the time, or at least wasn't fully known at the time. You did have Masonic groups like the Rosicrucians who were talking about it. So in this case, remember, for the American founding fathers, without exception, democracy was a bad word. Democracy was a degenerate, almost a pathological form, not just of government, but of society. He's not even talking about government here. He's just talking about people doing whatever they want, because democracy, for all of them, and it still is today, is identical with the removal of any absolute truths about the family, about the state, about our actions and virtues in accordance with natural law and therefore creation. That's what democracy meant. From Aristotle to the founding of America, it was a bad word. It was degeneracy. So anyone using that now is just either deliberately being dishonest or illiterate, and I can never tell which one it is. But because whenever you remove the idea of truth, you don't have anything left but power and will. Well, John Adams says when that happens, the most powerful will prevail and will be able to impose itself on everything else. And there's really no way, if you're just pursuing your self-interest and a far more powerful person dominates you pursuing the same self-interest, then you have no right to complain. What is your foundation? The notion of natural law and absolute justice and nations and families. That's the foundation for any revolt. For any, you have to have a place to stand if you're going to tell the state to stop, if you're going to tell the regime that you can't do what it's doing. You have to have a strong foundation. But what he's saying here is that democracy, the whole purpose is to destroy that foundation. And then there is absolutely no grounds from which you can revolt and tell the regime to stop. Now, he's talking about democracy also as against aristocracy. That's what he means by powers of wealth, beauty, wit, and science. He's talking about people who are independent. They're not dependent on other people for their income, for their self-esteem. They're independent, and even in the Jeffersonian sense, despite those them being rivals, in that they're autonomous. No one tells them what to do. They have the kind of middling income that no one can tell them what to do. They have their own land and everything else. And from that comes legitimate independence and political opinions that come from reason rather than from the crowd or from the media or anything else. That's the first thing that's going to come under attack when you have so-called democracy. The notion that all opinions are equal, we're all the same, until you realize that they don't really believe that. The only opinions that matter are those who run the revolution in the first place, those who promote this democratic ideal. They impose reality on you, and you better go along. And they'll destroy any independence, the way that, you know, the legitimate aristocracy, like John Adams is talking about, is the first thing that's going to go, because people like us are a legitimate threat to the system. And I'm very proud to call myself a threat to democracy, intellectually speaking. It's something that, you know, I got to start putting it on my resume as almost like a title, because we have the independence, the freedom that very few people other people have to tell the truth in an age where most people today are frightened to even mention.
Well, the professors certainly are. Well, most of the professors certainly are in the universities. So I guess what we're saying here is when you get rid of God, when you get rid of religion, there's no authority that you can appeal to, because the authority is there by might. It's just ruling by force, not ruling by virtue, that it should be there ruling because it has the virtue to rule, but that it just rules by force. And democracy itself, I think, is kind of like, instead of having the father rule in the household, which is the unit that the nation should be based upon the family, it should be based upon the father and the mother and the children and that and the hierarchy there. What you're saying with democracy is that we'll let the children decide. We'll let the children decide, and it will be the numbers that decide on things. So you no longer have objective truth. You just have whatever sounds best to the children, to the uneducated. So democracy becomes the rule of the mob. I also find it interesting that he's predicting all of this back then in 1763, and we're seeing the same thing playing out now. And Solzhenitsyn, in the next quote, he is basically saying that we deserve this. This is what we deserve for the way that we have behaved. And this is why we shouldn't have faith in people like Donald Trump to put everything right, because we're getting our just desserts, basically, for what went on in the past. Solzhenitsyn in the Gulag Archipelago, he says, "And how we burned in the camps later, thinking, what would things have been like if every security operative, when he went out at night to make an arrest, had been uncertain whether he would return alive and had to say goodbye to his family? Or if during periods of mass arrests, as for example in Leningrad, when they arrested a quarter of the entire city, people had not simply sat there in their lairs, paling with terror at every bang of the downstairs door and at every step on the staircase, but had understood they had nothing left to lose and had boldly set up in the downstairs hall an ambush of half a dozen people with axes, hammers, pokers, or whatever else was at hand. The organs would very quickly have suffered a shortage of officers and transport, and notwithstanding all of Stalin's thirst, the cursed machine would have ground to a halt. If we didn't love freedom enough, and even more, we had no awareness of the real situation, we purely and simply deserved everything that happened afterwards." And I think reading that, I mean, it just tells me these are the same people as us. If we think that we would be doing anything different than they did, you know, then we're living in a fantasy world. These are the same people as us. When they come to make the arrests of the people that tried to peacefully protest in the capital last week, they're just going to be arrested. The same thing is going to happen that happened here, because this is all the results of our previous actions. I don't think we can actually change this. I think this is what we should be learning from this, is that we cannot put our faith in man. We have to put our faith in God. Each time you put your faith in man, you will be let down. Each time man tries to say, well, I can do better, we can do better, we can make better laws than our ancestors followed, better laws than our religious people followed, this is the way that it ends up. You end up losing all of your freedoms, just like the Russians did in the Soviet Union, as Solzhenitsyn is outlining here. Do you want to comment on this, Matt?
Yeah, there's so much here. The first thing, he's talking about the security services themselves. He's talking about, you know, low-level officers. And we saw that happening with Biden purging the people, well, I guess National Guard from Texas, among other places, guarding this inauguration. Because nothing says unity more than a presidential inauguration on someone who has stolen an election, surrounded by miles of barbed wire and electric fences, with an army to protect them, and the army that the regime doesn't even trust. But what Solzhenitsyn is saying here is that if those guys who were actually going to make the arrests considered maybe this isn't the right thing, maybe making a good living isn't the only thing, maybe this is going to happen to me tomorrow, and by the way, it probably did, they wouldn't have been so quick to follow orders. He mentions Leningrad or Petersburg because it is always been the symbol of the degeneracy. It's Peter the Great's city, based on Western ideas of liberal authoritarianism. Then the next thing he's saying is that what would have happened if the people, instead of cowering all by themselves in their apartments in this deeply alienated city, if they had taken action? It happened in the U.S. right after the Revolution, Shays Rebellion, in the Whiskey Rebellion, where when they came to take people's lands and homes in order to pay debt, they took action. And that's what caused this broader rebellion that almost brought the whole Federalist system down. And that was the basis when Thomas Jefferson said, you know, the Tree of Liberty, you know, has to be watered. That was in reaction to that, where he said that. But when you have a city in a situation where no one trusts each other, everyone's so busy pursuing their self-interest, they don't know what it is to have true friends and allies and comrades. You have no one to trust. We have a system now, which we all predicted, based on snitching on each other. These websites, you get to tell on people. People are being encouraged, just like in the Soviet Union, children to tell on their parents, and they get awards for this. That's not being rebelled against. So when they actually come for them, they can't rely on anybody. When you don't have family, religion, and nation to unify you, what are you going to die for? What's the basis on which you cooperate? Solzhenitsyn here is saying if they just confronted these people armed, the Soviet Union couldn't have stood for very long at all. Said the organs would have quickly suffered a shortage of officers, and the machine would have ground to a halt. But they would rather go to the camps than do all the work to humbly, you know, sacrifice their ego for the sake of building community, and especially in that city. And that's why he said they deserve it. They didn't love freedom enough, because freedom is based on humility, on cooperation, parking your ego, and doing the hard work necessary to sacrifice for each other. If you're not going to do that, then when they come to get you, you're going to be all alone.
Well, it's based on genuine tolerance of other people's opinions, isn't it? Not trying to shut down people's opinions so that there are rifts in society like the rifts that we see now. I mean, what I see here is the consequences of our past actions. You cannot escape the consequences of your past actions. You can't escape the consequences of our actions as a nation. I'm not talking about your individual actions here, but that our actions as a nation have led us up to this point, and we have to find ways that we can struggle against it, fight against it, and defend ourselves against it, but it has to be within the framework that's already been set. If you go against the framework that's been set, then you're taking on the whole force of the state, and you just end up in the same situation that the people that went into the Capitol last week are in. I've said this for a long time. We have to, you know, it's no good trying to break the speech laws. We have to find ways that we can keep within the speech laws and still get our message out there, because those speech laws are the consequences of our past actions. The only way that you can change these things is to get our people into power. But that is, you know, that is not something that we can do in the here and now. We can hope and pray that that happens, and we can support good people politically when they get into those positions. But that's not what this is all about. If it's already been defined that people like Biden are going to get into power, it's already been defined. It's no good crying over spilt milk, as it were. The real battle is the personal battle. That's what all this is telling us. It's saying we shouldn't be so concerned about what is happening on the macro scale. We should be concerned about what is happening on the micro scale and what we do within our own lives. The whole of life is basically a test, and all of this is testing our virtue to see how virtuous we are. This is what we are supposed to struggle against. Like we were saying at the beginning there, Matt, about stand being the counter-revolutionaries. We need to be like that within our lives and standing up for what is right, standing up for what is virtuous. And so many of these things to do with nationalism, you know, being against homosexuality, being against race mixing. I mean, these things are, they're not extreme positions to hold. They're just a basic natural law, basic common law that we've always had that has now been turned on its head by the revolutionaries. And it all starts with this rejection of God. The final quote that I have here is from Edmund Burke and its Reflections on the Revolution in France from 1790. He says, when in the place of that religion of social benevolence and of individual self-denial, and he's obviously referring to Christianity there, in mockery of all religion, they institute impious, blasphemous, indecent, theatrical rites in honour of their vitiated, perverted reason, and erect altars to the personification of their own corrupted and bloody republic, when schools and seminaries are founded at public expense to poison mankind from generation to generation with the horrible maxims of this impiety, when wearied out with incessant martyrdom and the cries of a people hungering and thirsting for religion, they permit it, but only as a tolerated evil. I call this atheism by establishment. So I guess what he's talking about there is the corruption of the church and the raising up of these celebrities, erecting these altars to the personification of themselves, and these schools and seminaries founded at public expense. This is the brainwashing that is going on in our schools. And we can see from the adverts now on the television, they're not about selling the product. They're just about brainwashing people with degeneracy. And that's exactly what the schools are about. They're not about educating our people. I never went to university. I left school at 16. I've had to learn everything that I've learned. I've learned outside of school. The schools are just there to corrupt people's minds and brainwash them with anti-natural ideas that take people away from God more than anything else. Matt, what are your thoughts on his Edmund Burke's quote here?
Again, this, you know, Reflections, the book's one of the great classics of our literature. And it's one of the few more or less conservative books that's actually still studied in the university. And of course, my experience in the university is extensive. And although as a young man, I had a great time, I still knew that it had limits. Just my freshman year alone, it wasn't even lecturing. It was just an open mockery of everything family-based and tradition-based. And the university system isolates you from your home, which is, you know, a step one in brainwashing, complete isolation. It's like going to boot camp. You're then surrounded by bacchanalia, which I have to admit I took part in way too much, essentially breaking down your connections to home and everything that you used to hold dear. And this especially affects the women to a great extent. You see how they mutilate themselves and dye their hair and have stick things in their face and all the rest of it over, you know, just a few months in the university. And then they fill this now emptied mind with utter propaganda. And there's nothing you could do about it. You say one thing. It was bad when I was there. Can you imagine how it is now? You say one thing, and God forbid it's on a racial issue. They will mobilize whether it be the GLAD organization or the African American Student Union, whatever they're called, and they will single you out. The worst example of this was after Charlottesville. My friend Dan Cleave, University of Nebraska, was hounded out of that school as a biology major, which, of course, you can't do from home because he was at Charlottesville, just like what's happening to the guys who were at the Capitol. The basketball team at the university wore shirts on court that week condemning him. The entire university. You had people, Jewish students writing for the newspaper saying, I'm afraid to go on campus because Dan Cleave may kill me. That's how absurd it got. And that the university can't continue if he's on this campus. I wrote a letter to the Alumni Association. Of course, it wasn't published. I contacted as many people there as I could. But it is, and I've said this for a long time, the university campus is an experiment in what the society is going to be like very soon. Your internet is tightly controlled. There are thousands of sites that are blocked if you use the university servers. And peer pressure is so intense to support leftist politics in one form or another that those who, myself included, those who resist are in for a tough time. I mean, I got away with it, but that was in 1990, 1993, 1994. But I don't think that can happen now. And you have our people, including, God forbid, you're a professor there, who are absolutely terrified. Young professor going into a university, realize just if they're a white male, they're not going to get tenure and have probably the easiest job in the world unless they spout the line. That's the only thing that matters when they vote on tenure in 6 years. So that means he has to completely be the most radical person on campus so he can never be called a racist or a sexist. And you'll see the most fanatical actions taken against anyone who disagrees, believe it or not, in the name of freedom of speech. The complete subversion of reason and logic. And they do this out of fear. I mean, there's a few who may actually agree, but they do it because it's the best job in the world. They're very rare, and they want it more than anything, and they will do anything. And it's so easy to destroy a white male student because he has nowhere to go. And you'll be congratulated if you destroy such a person. I saw it in its beginning, and now we're seeing its fruition. And what the system at the universities, again, funded often with taxpayer money, is a mini version of what they want to impose on everything here. And I think that's really what he's talking about when he says, you know, schools and seminaries founded at the public expense. And then he also says, you know, you have people suffering, thirsting for religion, thirsting for truth, who don't know where to go. They don't know what the alternative is because anyone offering an alternative is hounded out of existence, removed, censored, and everything else. This was happening in the French Revolution, and it happened in every revolution. That's how revolutions go. Being a counter-revolutionary was a one-way ticket to the guillotine or the gulag or anything else. And the symbol, of course, was the monarch. You have the same fate as this. That's why it was always a ritual, whether it be Charles or Louis or Nicholas. It was a ritual of some kind. And the fact that Burke is using, you know, theatric rites, altars, he's making it very explicit that these are sort of a semi-religious, ritualistic thing to do to brainwash people. This is what happens. Our people are frightened to death. You're at a university. I don't know how you're going to do it. I don't know how white cops do it anymore. It's absolute terror. And this is a more modern idea of atheism by establishment. People will go along because they're scared. They want to get their education. They want to do what they need to do. And so many people now aren't saying anything because they're terrified. And this is how revolutions go. This is one of the ways you know that we're in the middle of the ending of a revolution that's been going on since the 1960s, at least, where the Supreme Court was this top-down authority. Now, of course, they have enough mobilized people at the local level, especially in the cities, that you open your mouth, you're in trouble financially, personally, socially, and God knows emotionally. That's why we have to support each other no matter what the cost.
Well, they don't just come down on the true teachers. They put forward the false teachers as well, don't they? We have false teachers teaching falsehoods to people that are thirsting for religion. And that's why it's so important that we have people like yourself, Matt, that are teaching the truth to people. And I don't mean to put myself forward as somebody who's particularly educated. As I say, I'm not educated, But you do, if you have a thirst for knowledge, and we all do have a thirst for knowledge, then you're not going to find that satiated by going to these universities. You're going to be taught falsehoods there. You have to be proactive and go out and find this information for yourself. And at least we do still have our alternative media, and we can still get this information out, and we can still reach people. And it's important that people that listen to us reach out and talk to other nationalists about these things and about these subjects, and stress how important it is that this is all about the individual battle. This is what it tells us when we have these failures, like Donald Trump failing when our opponents end up being able to steal the election. It's because all of that side of it is not meant to happen. It's the results of our previous actions. What we are meant to do is show virtue in our individual lives, and we will be tested in our individual lives, and that's what the whole point of this is about. It's about improving your spirit and improving your character and being a good man. And that is what white people were created to do. We were created to be good. We're in the image of our creator, and this is why our opponents hate us so much, and this is why they seek to degrade us and degenerate us and test us as much as they can. Andrew Anglin wrote a very good article along these similar lines today or yesterday, and he was pointing out, you know, we're never tested more than we can actually withstand. And the testing is all actually for our benefit. And there is always a way out. We just have to see it. You know, we don't just get tested with horrible things happening to us. There is always a path that we will be able to see. You just have to struggle to see it. And a lot of the time, it's going to be a very hard path to take. It may mean that you have to eat humble pie, or, you know, you have to admit that you've been wrong in the past. But it is the correct path to take, and it will improve you, it will improve your character, and it will improve the lives of the people around you, improve the lives of the white people around you. And that's what we need to be doing. We need to be learning how to survive in the world that we now have. It is a fallen world, and we are promised victory. We know that the victory has already happened, but because we're here in the mortal world, we haven't quite got to that stage yet. But also, when we see that all these bad things happen here, it's because we know that in the eternal realm, it's all the good things that happen. It's the good guys that are in charge. God is a just God. He's not going to, just punish people all the time. The bad guys have to have done something first in order to be punished. And they will be punished, and we will have victory in the end. Matt, I don't know if you want to comment on that or any more of the religious aspects of this.
Well, people who've been listening to me for a long time, back when I was on The Voice of Reason and even before, I laid out, God, from maybe 2005, 2010, a list of things that we should be doing. I mentioned watching what we eat, watching the processed foods, building up our strength, physical and mental, teaching ourselves how to keep our cool, especially in public. Teaching ourselves to pick our fights. You don't have to fight everybody. You don't have to debate everybody. I would keep our debating in writing, like on the social media, rather than verbally. Focus on a certain area of policy or law rather than trying to know everything. God Almighty, please avoid alcohol. Learn about self-defense. Be integral. Have one personality. Try with every fiber of your being to leave the city. I was talking about moving out into the country, creating some kind of agrarian commune back in 2008 at least, and how difficult that's going to be because there's a lot of work involved. Even some of you who know how to raise your own food, that makes you a threat right away. But I'm telling you, the biggest threat and the biggest thing that everyone can do here, the biggest threat to the regime is to create large families. Make lots of babies and grow them up as best as you can. You know, if I can do it, any of you can do. And I did it without a whole lot of problems, without many problems. I mean, no one came to my door, nothing like that. You're quiet, you're intelligent, you're kind to everybody. And, you know, you should be able to slide by. But there is nothing more threatening to the regime than strong families, strong patriarchies based on justice, religion, and natural law. All the church fathers talked about the home as the cell of the church. Their small parishes, their small monasteries. You know, my children grew up with the faith in their backyard. You know, it was a day-to-day part of their life. Nothing was ever forced on them. This is just, you know, it became just part of being in a family. It changes everything. And maintain their innocence for as long as humanly possible. You don't need a TV. And this is, needless to say, you know, pornography and this kind of sex addiction has got to be stopped immediately. You know, pornography and alcohol are two things that are tearing us apart. And if that's even done halfway, the victory is already won. And that's why that kind of thing, it's not directly political, but that kind of thing is such a threat to our opponents.
Well, I think our opponents would just like us to think about this politically and what political party can we get into power. But it's not. It's about our individual selves and who we are as white people. We need to work on providing support communities for our people and helping our people out when they're in need. I talked earlier this week about a study in ethnocentricity that was done, a computer simulation about ethnocentricity and various groups and in a competition. And the group that wins is the group that is most charitable towards its own and most indifferent to the other groups. And, you know, that's what religion tells us to do. It tells us to be charitable to our own. And we don't need to be mean to the other groups, just be indifferent to them. Just make sure that your work is to the benefit of your own people and not to the benefit of others. And religion tells us we'll win. The computer simulation tells us that we'll win. And this is what our ancestors told us. This is how we are supposed to be. We're supposed to be charitable to our own people. And we're tested in that all the time. And it's very hard to sometimes look at these left-wing white people and Antifa and think, you know, and love them, you know, because they do so many horrible things. But they are our brothers. They are just misled, and all they need to do is hear the truth. And as white people, we all have a yearning to hear the truth, and that's why they put so much effort into trying to silence it, and that's why we put so much work into getting it out there so that people can hear it, particularly at Radio Albion. I mean, all of us hosts here, we put so much work into this so that we can get a positive message out to our people and help improve their lives, because we know a lot of people are going to be very distraught at what's just happened. But we have to understand that we are living in the middle of a revolution, and we cannot put our faith in men. It happens again and again and again. Every time you put your faith in man, it will be a failure. And every time you put your faith in God, it will be a success. And you know, this computer simulation points to that as well. Matt, have you got any final words for tonight that you'd like to say?
Don't be taken in by this notion of Christianity where Christ is depicted as some long-haired hippie going around talking, loving everybody, loving, of course, being unlimited indulgence. Christ was difficult. He was very strict. He used violence. And, you know, when necessary, especially to cleanse the temple, none of this is against the faith. Don't allow any of these clergymen to let you believe that self-defense or self-protection, family protection, is somehow non-Christian. That Tolstoy nonsense has got to be absolutely be purged. The Old Testament is in the Bible for a reason, and it's much longer than the New Testament. There, in the prophets especially, you find the family doctrine, political doctrine, and economic doctrine. This is why no one reads it. These are things that our people have to worry about. And the Old Testament needs to be a day-to-day part of our lives, and because that is what Christ assumed that his hearers knew. Understand what the church really says about these kind of things.
And I think we have to look around us and understand that the way everything is, it's the way it is because it's trying to correct us. And the correct path is not the path that our leaders are telling us. The correct path is there with our intuition and with our help from our religious texts, which you will find are in tune with your intuition, because that's the way we are meant to be as white men. So don't lose hope and don't lose faith. Keep the faith. Thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio with Horus, covering more Culture of Critique. So until then, we hope you all have a great weekend.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.